I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from the New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week, we're going to be talking about Louis Theroux's new documentary, My Scientology Movie, and the Divine Comedy's latest album, Foreverland.
Caroline has also watched Game of Thrones for the first time, so she'll be telling us how that went later on in the show.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. It's been a wild and crazy week in the world of Seriously, hasn't it, Caroline?
Yeah, it really has. We have quite a big announcement for our listeners. We were hoping it would be bigger than it is, because we're doing our first ever live Seriously event, which is going to be a Gilmore Girls quiz on the 22nd of November. We were hoping on this episode to be able to say, hey everyone, come to our quiz, but it's already sold out.
Yeah, we were really surprised. If we'd been more optimistic, we might have said, okay, we'll wait until we're recording the new episode before we put the ticket link live. But we just didn't expect it to sell out, and it sold out in well under 24 hours, so we were quite surprised.
Yeah, so I feel kind of guilty that this is the first time we're mentioning it on the podcast and we're sort of having to say, sorry guys, it's already full. But we are running a waiting list. So either if you desperately want to come and don't yet have a ticket, go to seriouslypod.com and click on events and you can sign up for it. Or if you have already bought a ticket but now know you can't come, please email us, because there are people who are desperate to come.
Yeah, exactly. So we're really, really excited. And the success of the event so far encourages us to perhaps do some more.
Obviously, we'll try and make sure listeners hear first. But also, maybe you should all follow us on Twitter and Facebook to find out about this stuff further in advance.
We've had some absolutely stellar emails this week. We've got one here from Joe, who emailed in about Harry Potterverse films, which is obviously an ongoing topic of interest to Seriously.
So this is in response to the news that there are going to be 5 films focusing on the Great Wizarding War, right? So the first one is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, mm-hmm. that comes out in November, right?
Yeah, so it's this film that they sort of advertised as being about Newt Scamander. It's sort of becoming slowly more obvious that actually the bigger story that they're going to focus on is this big war that we know happened between Gellert Grindelwald and Albus Dumbledore. That was the big final battle of a war started by Grindelwald over many years, where he was basically trying to suppress all Muggles, essentially. And it runs sort of parallel to the actual Second World War, which has the potential to be quite interesting. But yeah, 5 full movies are going to be devoted to that timeline, which is a lot.
J.K. Rowling hates the word prequel.
Yeah, she really hates it.
I don't know why.
She hates it so much.
I don't know what she would call it, but basically these seem to be stories cited earlier in the timeline of the Wizarding World. So books 1 to 7 and films 1 to 7A, 7B that we've had focus on the story of Harry Potter. These are the events in the same world as Harry Potter, but like 60 years before.
And that we've heard about in the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, that have been
and
referenced.
Sometimes involve the same characters, but younger. But it's not a prequel.
So I don't know what she'd call a prequel, but whatever.
Yeah. Joe just got in touch to say, if there's going to be 5 films about the Great Wizarding War, and this is a story JK wished to tell, does this suggest we may be getting the novels around these films as well? Doubtful, I'd say.
She hasn't said anything about that, has she?
I don't think that there's going to... Certainly not written by JK Rowling. And then he's also said, if they're about Grindelwald, does this mean that there's likely to be some actual LGBT content in any of these films? I'd say no.
I agree with you that I just don't think that's going to happen.
It would be nice, and there'll probably be lots of queer baiting ahead of the film's release, but I doubt we'll actually see, for example, Dumbledore and Grindelwald actually having a relationship of any kind. We might get some, like, I loved you once, Grindelwald, but no longer sort of dialogue. But I think that's as far as it will go. But yeah, I'm really excited for these new films, actually. I'm holding back cynicism because I actually like the look of the trailer. I like the idea of going back to this story. So I'm hoping it'll be good. I won't have super high expectations because cursed child. but they're pretty middling so far.
Yeah, no, I am really excited about the Fantastic Beasts film, actually. And I was, before I knew any of this, actually, just purely based on the fact that it looked like a really nice film.
Mm.
Like, well-made, interesting, some surprising elements, all from the trailer.
Several animals with excellent visual attributes, including Eddie Redmayne's nice hair.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so I'm even more interested to know that it's kind of, as you said in your piece that you wrote about this, that the animals are a kind of possibly flashy distraction from, like, a bigger story about the Nazis of the Wizarding World.
Yeah, exactly. So fun stuff.
We've also had, I think, possibly my favourite email we've ever had to this podcast.
Whoa.
I know, strong words from me, but Tom emails, picking up on something from our discussion of The Girl on the Train last week. It said, your discussion led me to pick up a copy not of Paula Hawkins' novel, but of Agatha Christie's The 450 from Paddington.
Right, this is because you brought up the fact that there's a whole genre of, like, train commuter-based crime, which begins or has some origins in this Agatha Christie novel.
Yes, and I'm so happy with myself because he said, I've not read a Christie novel before, but Caroline's description of the murder mystery story piqued my interest.
Oh, well done.
It's basically all I want from life, to turn people onto Agatha Christie novels who haven't already read them.
Your Christie propaganda mission finally getting some results.
He says, it turns out Christie was doing a bit of subtle product placement for U2. She describes a very old man travelling in a first-class carriage reading the New Statesman. I just thought the circularity of these things was funny.
That's so cute.
And he attached to his email a picture of the page. And I'm just going to read the couple of sentences. It says, the train was not crowded. 4:33 was before the evening rush hour. Of the first-class carriages, only one had an occupant, a very old gentleman reading the New Statesman.
Ah, that's so great.
It's also really nice when you work for a magazine that is a kind of cultural signifier going back decades. Mm. So presumably the reason Agatha Christie said that, a very old gentleman reading the New Statesman, was because she knew the reader would instantly be able to picture that person.
Yeah, or they probably know an uncle who reads the New Statesman. Or...
exactly.
That's really funny. I like that. So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is My Scientology Movie, the first feature-length film from British documentary maker Louis Theroux. As no current Scientologists agree to appear in his film and refuse to respond to his requests, Louis decides to take matters into his own hands, using a combination of dramatic reconstruction, footage of attempted access, and interviews with ex-members.
Hello. Can I just give you a letter? We're doing a documentary about Scientology.
Scientology. A religion created by a sci-fi writer, run by a mysterious leader, David Miscavige.
So this is my chance to experience Scientology firsthand.
You need to leave.
How are you doing, Mr. Squirrel?
You guys are trespassing.
Got anything to say?
It's okay, we have a permit.
Why are you here?
He's right behind us now.
We have their attention.
Why are they doing this?
It's just not like any church that you can think of.
So it's quite a surreal mishmash of different things, this film. I don't know, I was sort of struggling to go along with it, I'd say, in the first maybe 20 minutes or so.
Likewise, and then I got completely hooked.
You have these sort of, I think they're becoming fairly traditional in their own right now, these shots of Louis, you know, door knocking and approaching certain buildings in his car and getting turned away and waving a permit and stuff. That's sort of like the documentary maker trying to make his documentary style footage is something, you know, you hear about it in like Searching for Sugar Man and stuff like this. But that gets boring quite quickly, I think, sometimes. And so what he does instead is this whole casting of actors who could play the different big players in the Scientology church, who can read out things like official documents and stuff, or reenact prominent TV interviews. And that's his way of, what he says, trying to like get into the heads of these Scientologists.
Yeah, and I do think it's actually more effective than it sounds, because he does it in conjunction with former Scientologists who knew the people these actors are playing personally. Mm-hmm. So both you trust that the actors they're casting are actually a good fit for the role because there's someone with personal knowledge of the person. But also watching the interaction of the former Scientologist with the actor pretending to be the big figure in Scientology is revealing in its own right.
So for me, it's funny, I didn't find the reenactment stuff convincing at all in terms of the like getting into the brains of these Scientologists, because obviously these are just actors no matter how well they're sort of playing a part. But I think you're right in that they become useful in all kinds of different ways. And I think it was potentially quite a cynical move and a clever move on Theroux's part to say, oh yeah, we're making this movie, casting these people. Because A, you get all these ex-Scientologists like Marty Rathbun, as you say, reacting to them in ways that are revealing. And all the current Scientologists also get quite angered by his attempts to make this film. So that's when they actually start getting in contact with them.
Yeah.
He has no contact with any of these Scientologists at all. And then as soon as he starts trying to make a film about them, casting people to play Tom Cruise or the head of Scientology, that's when they start getting all these legal threats. That's when Scientologists start turning up to at places that they're filming with their own cameras and start filming them. And suddenly you've got some actual interaction with real Scientologists. So it's quite a clever honey trap in that sense.
Yeah, it's a really good provocative move, actually. I'd say that, like you, I didn't find the reenactments themselves particularly interesting or revealing. You're right, it's what they did for the filmmaking process maybe that was more important, apart from in one instance where they are reenacting the so-called drills.
I found this scene really interesting too.
Scientologists do, which as far as I can tell comes down to sitting like knee to knee with someone in two chairs facing each other and then just trying to freak them out, so like yelling at them as loud as you can or like demeaning them or basically training them not to react no matter what. And they also get trained in something called, is it tone 40, which is like your loudest, most authoritative projected voice. And so that in itself is quite interesting, seeing how like Louis Theroux reacts to that and the other actors. But then later on, when they're having interactions with current Scientologists, I'm particularly thinking of that woman called Catherine, who's one of the people who tries to like chase them off from filming outside a big Scientology venue.
Yeah, and she was married to a Scientologist who like left the church and wrote a tell-all memoir about it.
And who does appear in the film. But having seen the reconstruction of them doing the drills, you could see her doing tone 40.
Exactly.
And the way she was just completely, because at one point Louis starts kind of, not exactly shouting at her, but like quite aggressively saying, well, what do you want us to do, Catherine? Why do you think we're here? Why won't you be in the film? And she's just completely impervious. You're like, oh, right, so yeah, decades of doing those drills will do that for you.
Yeah, and you also see what they've learned in the ball baiting, as they call it, drill, which is when you try and provoke someone, not just what they've learned in not being provoked, but what they've learned in trying to provoke someone, because all of these ex-Scientologists come and follow Marty Rathbun wherever he goes, and they say things like, why are you doing this? Why are you being a squirrel, they call it, and what, you know, is it because you're a loser? Is it because you never really succeeded in the church? And making veiled comments about his children and stuff, and it becomes really, really nasty, and you see all the tactics they've learned for trying to get to people really coming to the fore as well. So I agree with you completely that out of all the reenactment bits, those scenes where you see what the training of Scientologists actually looks like is really useful.
Another thing that I found quite revealing in the reenactment, in a slightly more meta sense, is that there's that relatively short interview with the young man who joined Scientology when he first moved to LA to become an actor. And he describes how, you know, he opened his first issue of like Stage magazine to look at the audition listings, saw a thing about want to break into the business, come to the Church of Scientology, and got involved that way. And he describes how attractive the church is to like a young actor, basically how young actors just so perfectly fit the psychological profile of someone who would want to be involved in Scientology. And then you see them casting all of these young actors to play famous Scientologists, and there's that bit where Marty Rathbun walks out of the reenactment because he's not comfortable with them pretending to applaud the portrait of L. Ron Hubbard, because he says something like, you know, I think you've kind of crossed a line now between pretending to do the thing and just doing the thing. And that, I think, is interesting, the fact that Scientology is so inextricably bound up with Hollywood and the idea of celebrity, and the fact that Louis was like using that.
It's really interesting that moment, because what he says when he leaves is he's like, you know, I've left one cult and here we are starting a new cult, the cult of Louis Theroux. And then you stand, because Louis Theroux has been telling everyone. He's been like the director of explaining when they should applaud, when they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And so they're all applauding this fake portrait of that's not really there of L. Ron Hubbard. And Louis Theroux's just sort of stood there receiving their applause. Mm. And it's a really funny shot. And, you know, it's obviously done in a very tongue-in-cheek way. But as someone who like really does love Louis Theroux and is part of all these communities that really idolise him, it's just a really like bizarre and interesting moment in the documentary.
Mm, yeah. And it's also just such an interesting film as a whole, because it is like a meta commentary on the idea of not being able to make a film.
Mm-hmm. But always stuff. With a sort of smile. And it's very playful, this film, which yeah. I think is nice. It's not taking itself too seriously. It's not like we tried so hard to get into Scientology and yet they refused. It's funny. So there's a whole farcical argument about whether or not the road that they want to film on is a public road or road that belongs to the Church of Scientology because they own the land.
Mm.
So there's all this constant like, it's a public road. No, it's not. It's not a public road. The police come. The police are like, oh, we're not sure. We think it's actually a private road. We think they can do what they want. And then at the end of the film, after it's gone to credits, that they've got all these sort of like, you know, Marty Rathbun now does this, that you sort of get at the end of these documentaries. And then what it just comes up with, it was a public road.
That is funny.
Really made me laugh.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now we're going to talk about Foreverland, which is the 11th studio album by the Northern Irish alt-pop band The Divine Comedy. You may know them from such 90s singles as National Express and Generation Sex. The songs on this latest album are written and largely performed by Neil Hannon, who has been the group's only constant member over their 3 decades of work. It's also won them their highest ever UK album chart position, peaking at number 7.
Loved that Troy McClure style intro there, like, you may remember I the Divine Comedy from such 90s singles as...
Well, this raises an interesting point, right? Because I am a massive fan of the Divine Comedy. They are my music love beyond everything else.
Oh.
And I have no sense of how much anyone else knows about this.
Well, I remember when we went to the David Bowie proms in reinterpretation night, and you were like, oh my god, Neil Hannon from Divine Comedy is going to be... And I was like, yeah, that guy. And Stephanie and you were both like, what? Like, how can you not know who this is? Stephanie is a colleague of ours who works in the office. I didn't really know who the fuck they were. And so this has been my year of introduction to Neil Hannon and the Divine Comedy.
As I say, I have literally no sense of how well-known they are. I mean, I know they're well enough known for, you know, the band to still exist and for them to put out albums every few years and for every time there's an album, Neil Hannon does an interview in The Guardian, you know, that kind of thing. But this is the first time their album seems to have had any particular chart impact. And it's also the first time in a long time that they've done such an extensive UK tour. Like, normally they play a couple of dates in London and Manchester and maybe Dublin and Belfast and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they're touring for like a year and they're playing Cambridge and Liverpool and Gateshead and lots of small venues in small towns. And they're all selling out.
That's amazing.
So I think finally Neil Hannon and the Divine Comedy have kind of transitioned into the social media age. They've realised they've got this small but dedicated fan base, and they're finally like capitalising on that and going to where those people are.
Who would you align them alongside? Like, for example, like in the 90s, would you put them alongside like Pulp?
Yeah, Pulp.
Yeah?
Neil Hannon has said he's a massive fan of Jarvis Cocker.
Okay. Because I feel like in the same way that there are men out there who, if Jarvis Cocker, for example, writes some sort of like wanky think piece, will just religiously read it. Mm. And I feel like Neil Hannon is a similar sort of figure where if he like says something publicly, a lot of people would be like, ah, well, Neil Hannon's thoughts on this are, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the same way, not to the same extent as Morrissey. That's a bad comparison because obviously Morrissey is so big and a bit earlier, but in that kind of vein.
I mean, I'm slightly too young to be in this group, but there are definitely people maybe 5-7 years older than me who grew up with the Divine Comedy being their like principal musical interest, and they reveled in the fact that it was quite niche even in the 90s.
Mm.
And that was very much their identity.
Mm.
Neil Hannon himself definitely identifies Jarvis Cocker as his like main contemporary influence. He wrote a piece for the New Statesman a few weeks ago about song lyrics, and in it he kind of says, please do another album, Jarvis. You know, he identifies himself as a fan of Jarvis Cocker.
That's great.
I think the band's biggest commercial hits were sort of like 96 through to 2000. Stuff like National Express, which got used on the National Express advert. That was his kind of Britpop moment, even though he wasn't really Britpop in the senses of Pulp and Oasis and Blur.
I think the lyrical playfulness, it is that piece he wrote for us about lyrics is, I think, quite revealing about the band as a whole, because I think that definitely is what he shares with Pulp. And I like how on this latest album, so these are sort of songs that reference Catherine the Great and Napoleon, and they're still very silly. There's like a sort of tweeness to them, but because it's all a bit tongue-in-cheek, it's funny and it doesn't feel too pretentious or...
Yeah, exactly. So I really like the song Catherine the Great, actually, which starts, the opening lyrics of it are, let's talk of Catherine the Great, let's talk of love and the power of the state.
Yeah, but it's done in this very jovial sort of style.
Yeah.
I have to say, this whole album, and Caroline also very kindly made me a sort of précis of other Divine Comedy songs via a Spotify playlist, they reminded me so much of this David Bowie song called Kooks. Do you know that one?
No, I
don't
know that one.
It's on Hunky Dory, I want to say.
Will you stay in a lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing.
I mean, I don't know if it's because it was already in my mind that Neil Hannon sounds quite a lot like David Bowie when he sings, because we had seen him sing Bowie songs at that proms event. But lyrically, and in that sort of like, we're a little strange, but we're happy kind of like bouncy melody, tinkly stuff in the background, it really reminded me of that song and a couple of songs on that album, which is the album that has like Changes and stuff like that on. And I really enjoyed it. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it, actually, because I was sort of ready to be like, these guys are going to feel a little bit irrelevant and probably just not be my sort of very mainstream poppy bag. But they were really fun. I think I would actually just like listen to that in the background of my work like quite regularly.
Did you have any other ones that you liked apart from Catherine the Great?
I liked the first track, which is Napoleon something.
Napoleon Complex.
I liked the duet he does with his wife.
Oh, Funny Peculiar.
Which is the one that really reminded me of Kooks, which is David Bowie's song about being like in a relationship and with his first child and stuff. I read a great Drowned in Sound review. We often sort of mention Drowned in Sound reviews because they are very good, where they said that that was sort of towing the line between like a Noel Coward style song or a Burt Bacharach style song and like a She and Him style horribly twee song.
Yeah.
And it just manages to stay on the right side of it, which I think is true.
So I went to the Divine Comedy's gig in Liverpool last week at the St George's Hall, and he performed that song with the support act, who's Lisa O'Neill, who's an Irish singer-songwriter. And because I previously actually thought it was too twee, that part of this album I didn't like. But their performance of it changed my mind, actually, because she's got a really quite edgy voice. And they did it really simply, just like sitting on stools facing each other. They didn't do any kind of like mugging to the audience or anything like that. They just sang it really simply. I was like, oh, this is actually a really sweet little song.
That's nice. So what else did the live performance make you thinking compared to the like studio album?
Couple of things. One, that I'm very, very reassured to find that Neil Hannon has been listening somehow to me and my friend Oscar, who've been saying this for years, and has finally realised that he is the front man of a band. Mm-hmm. He is not also a musician in that band.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a really good set of musicians with him, and he stands at the front and he sings, because that is what he's really good at.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to many, many Divine Comedy gigs in the past where Neil has also decided to try and play the piano, or sometimes the mouth organ, or the guitar. It's like, Neil, you're okay at this. Obviously good enough to like write your songs, but you cannot sing properly and do that.
At the same time.
Please stop it. And he's finally realised, and it's fantastic. I think also he must have taken quite a lot of singing lessons for that David Bowie song that he did at the proms, because that was
really great,
really vocally challenging. And he's sounding fantastic, really good. What's interesting is, because so often when you go and see a band live, the instrumentation is different as it is from the album, because, you know, they can't have a string orchestra or whatever. But largely, it stands up pretty much the same. Like, he's got someone playing the accordion, and he's got someone playing synth with all the different sounds. So actually, it does sound quite similar.
You're such a fan that
I am.
You're going again this week.
Yes, I am.
To see them again with a bunch of friends, which I think is adorable.
Yeah, so I'm going with a group of my friends from school.
Who have presumably been to that particular venue with you in the past.
Also, my mum and my friend Oscar's parents are coming too.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Because that's how entrenched the Divine Comedy is in our lives, that we take our parents to these things too.
I'm so pleased for you. I hope it's as good as the last one, and I hope you have a fantastic time.
Yeah, and I hope people check out this album who maybe haven't heard of them before. I might actually publish the link to my Spotify playlist as well, if anyone
very
wants
good
to
decision.
Get into the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, we should put that in the show notes for sure.
I just can't get her out of my mind. And when I sleep, I visualize her. I saw her in the pub. I met her later at the nightclub. A mutual friend.
So last week, I recommended that Caroline watch an episode of... That's right, Game of Thrones. Sorry, that was so embarrassing. But
that was great, I loved it.
So the episode that I recommended after many discussions with my boyfriend was Two Swords, which is the first episode of season 4 of Game of Thrones. It comes after two very, very high-profile, controversial episodes because there's a lot of death in them. As you can tell, guys, this is going to be a spoilerific discussion, so if you're behind on Game of Thrones, then, you know, disappear. It was the first episode of the fourth season. It broke ratings records for that season. I think it was when it first tipped over 6 million viewers for an episode. And it also got really good critical reviews, most notably for the final scenes of the episode involving Arya Stark, which was why I chose this one for you, because you are an Arya Stark fan, right?
I am. So it's not entirely true to say that I haven't seen Game of Thrones before in the manner of this segment. I've seen about half of the first episode, or the very first episode of the first series, which I watched after finishing all of the novels, thought it was rubbish, never watched it again.
Mm-hmm.
Until watching this episode on your recommendation, which both confirmed a lot of things that I'd like heard in the culture chat about Game of Thrones, and also surprised me in some ways. The things it confirmed for me is that Game of Thrones is kind of objectifying of women.
Yeah. Were there particular moments that you were like, ew, guys?
The bit where someone's being shown a selection of prostitutes.
They all just sort of stood there.
Yeah, and someone just like takes her clothes off and she has to stand there naked while some men lecture her.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a classic.
That is kind of what I've been led to expect from Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
from its reviews and general chat about it. Something also that I'd wondered how they were going to deal with in the TV show that is a problem in the books is all the different storylines running concurrently.
Mm.
So have you read the books? I can't remember.
Not at all.
No. So the way it does it in the books is each chapter is written third person from the perspective of a different character. And he roughly moves you around the world in a sort of cinematic sense. So you'll get like someone in King's Landing, then someone in the North, then someone in Dorne. And he just about manages to take you back to the same storyline often enough that you don't forget what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering, like, how would they recreate that in the TV series? And the answer is basically in exactly the same way.
Well, it reminds me structurally of Downton Abbey, in that it's like maybe 10 plots, 10 minutes each over an hour. And obviously there's a lot less overlap because in Downton Abbey, all the characters are in one house and they're all interacting. But this, it's a lot more like one person's in this part of the country and the other one's all across the sea and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's my sort of closest TV analogy, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a really big multi-strand drama, really, yeah. So I was interested to see how they did that. I was also interested to see how little, like, of the landscape was in this episode.
Yeah.
Maybe it just so happens that it's, like, no one was travelling in this one.
And there are lots of descriptions of fields and shit in the books.
I feel like in the books people are doing nothing but like being on horseback between different places all the time.
There is a lot of that in the show too, but there's not so many like lingering shots of the I mean, they literally show a shot of the wall, like a big like, you're raising your neck, you're looking up, oh, it's still there, hasn't disappeared into the horizon yet, you know, that kind of shot of the wall all the time. But yeah, I'm not sure they do loads of that. So what were the things that surprised you?
It surprised me how detailed it was.
Because
I think I'm pretty accustomed to when I'm watching an adaptation of something I've read that they have to, for the sake of screen time, cut stuff out, cut people out, merge characters for it to make sense. Whereas I guess I hadn't really appreciated how big a production Game of Thrones is. So they've kept all the storylines in, they've kept all the characters in.
That's great.
And they just made it massive.
Yeah.
So that was surprising to me.
Yeah.
I thought it would have been simplified.
So did you like it or no?
I neither liked it nor disliked it. I actually felt quite similar to how I feel about the books, which is that my interest in it is entirely plot-driven. I want to know what happens, and then I don't want to think about it anymore.
Yeah. What did you think of Arya's stabby scene?
So that was the only part that made me go, ooh, I actually want to see more of her. Because I felt like that was the first time in the episode where I was like, ah, there is some deeper art to this. Because, you know, we had the whole scene at the beginning where Tywin Lannister was recasting the famous Stark sword into two different swords. And you're like, ah, so that's the two swords of the title. And then you're like, oh no, it's not.
There's another
sword. Her sword Needle that she gets back from the person who stole it and then she uses to do some badass fighting with.
Yeah, and it's a reference to the fact that he stole that sword from her and he killed a little kid, basically, in the same manner by stabbing him in the middle of the neck like that and watching all the blood bubble out of his throat. So it's another sort of mirroring thing where she's taking her revenge by doing the same thing with the same sword.
I did have to do quite a lot of reading on the Game of Thrones wiki. Shout out to the fans who maintain the Game of Thrones wiki.
Yeah,
it's really good
work.
Because of coming in like four seasons in, not having seen stuff and also not having read the books for a few years. There was a really interesting comment in the notes section for this episode where it says that the two swords of the title refers to, you know, the one that Tywin offers Jaime, the recast
Valyrian steel
sword, but also to Arya's needle, and also highlights the fact that we thought that in the recasting of the Valyrian steel sword, like, that's the end of the Starks, their sword's been melted down, their might is gone, and then right at the end the second sword in Arya's hand reminds us that there is still Starks out there, they still got a chance.
Yeah,
so that is some good narrative arc.
Really good. And actually I'm currently watching series 5. I'm at the sort of getting to the end of series 5, and Valyrian steel swords and Starks continue to be a running theme.
Okay.
Towards the end of season 5, there's a big sword key scene. I'm glad that you didn't hate it perhaps as much as series 1.
I found it quite pacey. I think that was my problem with episode 1, series 1.
Totally agree.
It was just a lot of men standing
slow
in the snow wearing skins.
Yeah, dull. Agree.
And really dull.
It picks up. It takes a long time to get going, this series. I don't know why people like it so much, because I think, yeah, it's very slow.
So I'm glad to have like engaged with what is clearly a cultural behemoth of our time, but I'm not sure that I'm going to wade through the hundreds of episodes there must be by now.
Yeah.
I will read the books if and when they eventually come out.
Appear.
But I think the ship has sailed for me on becoming a Game of Thrones TV fan.
Fair enough. So what are you going to recommend me for next week?
I am going to recommend you something that is, I think, pretty much the opposite of Game of Thrones. It's as televisually as far you can get from the world of
Westeros.
Yes, that's the name of it.
Well, I think opposite of Game of Thrones is actually normally a good way to define my taste in stuff, so I'm excited.
So it is Crazy Stupid Love, which is a 2011 rom-com film, and it stars Julianne Moore, Steve Carell, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone.
So this came up when we were chatting about, I can't remember,
about La La Land.
Oh yeah,
last week when you were saying you'd seen that at the London Film Festival. because this is the film that is the origination of that clip of Emma Stone looking at Ryan Gosling's chest and going, seriously though.
Before they do the dirty dancing lift, I
exactly.
hear.
So yeah, this is a rom-com from 2011 in which Gosling and Stone are actually like the B couple. The A couple is Carell and Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And they are married and breaking up. And it's basically about Steve Carell's, like, I heard someone, a friend of mine once described it to me as it's like Steve Carell's version of like the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, because his wife,
I would watch the shit out of.
Yeah, his wife has cheated on him. She wants a divorce. And they were high school sweethearts or something, so he has to, like, get back out there and start dating again. And he ends up in this bar. Ryan Gosling, who's, like, this handsome, trendy player, takes pity on him and is like, mate, I'm going to take you shopping. I'm going to, like, teach you how to talk to women again.
You can just tell that in another life, Ryan Reynolds would have been cast in this yeah. role, don't you reckon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Ryans.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's basically principally about Steve Carell's, like, adventures of his penis.
Love it.
With a subplot of Ryan Gosling.
Adventures with his penis.
Yeah, well, it has some of that classic trope that we talked a bit about with The Sure Thing last week, where he first gets interested in Emma Stone because she's the only woman who's like, no thanks, mm-hmm. I don't wish to have sex with you. No, mm-hmm. bye-bye. And then, of course, he's like, I must have her.
Mm-hmm.
And it all
and
goes on
And then he
from
proves
there.
Her wrong.
Yeah.
Lol. But yeah, I can't wait. I'm excited. I love a rom-com. I think this was a Valentine's Day release.
I think
which
so,
sounds like
yeah.
it's probably right up my street.
Well, I think it's also recently just been added to UK Netflix because I hadn't thought about this film for ages. I first watched it on a plane or something and I just randomly saw loads of people tweeting about it. And that's why, because it's just appeared on Netflix.
Well, I will get my Netflix app open ASAP. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, including in iTunes, where you could also leave us a rating and a review because it helps other people find the show.
Our first ever live event, the Seriously Gilmore Girls quiz, is now sold out, sad face, but you can put your name on the waiting list by going to seriouslypod.com and clicking on events. Don't worry if you can't come, though. There will be a special episode of the podcast devoted to all things Stars Hollow as well.
Also on that website, you'll find all our back episodes, including our specials on Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're also available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell all your friends and family about the podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.